I'm not saying
she's my mother-in-law. What about me now?
No, no.
You gotta come across, John.
Then I think there are about four things which I'll deal with. Veronica, it might be a few things or to add some other things on that. The first is to contextualize the issue of public service deposits, that category which we have put in there. Now, that is not a prohibition. That municipalities should not raid those properties. This we are talking about things like schools, clinics, and the like. All what we are saying that is that because that is a critical service which government is providing, not for itself, but primarily directly to citizens. And that is the reason we have come with that particular category. Now, we think it is necessary for national government as a whole to monitor as to how that particular property category, how is rating being done. Because it's so fundamental. To give you an example, you see it with a particular issue that as you talk about extending these services to communities, now a mayor comes and says to national government, I want a police station. Now we move in, we build a police station. I want a hospital, I want a clinic, I want schools. We build the thing. Then 2 years or 3 years later, then you are being told that you brought the things which are needed. Now you have to pay higher rates. And when you talk about the budget process of the government, we need to take into account that there are a number of things which are being taken into account. So that is the reason that particular property category, we are not worried about the rest of property categories which the state is having, and it needs to be dealt with like in. So we said we need to get that particular impact so that as part of our central budget allocation processes, we take that into account as to what is it which it is saying, and where if trade-offs have to be made on that particular property category, not anything else which is owned by the state. If the issue of ratios which they were talking about, there is a possibility for it that it will have, it will come, but it can't be a prohibition. But it's only that for state-owned properties. The rest of state-owned properties, they will have to be dealt like any other thing. So that is that in a nutshell. Now, the second point which we might miss is this thing of the Valuation Appeal Board, the funding. Now, the issue is the Valuation Appeal Board are dealing with issues which emanate from valuations which municipalities are doing, and historically it's municipalities which have been funding this thing. But we feel, and I think that was the principal intention of the legislature when the Act came around as well, that it would be better for the MDC to be the ones which are responsible for establishment of this thing, because the other way then is to come with an alternative argument to say that given that municipalities are funding these things, let them create. And when you talk as to how many of these valuation appeal boards needs to be there, it can be something which MDCs just comes with a number of valuation appeal boards so that you have a lot of people to be there, but it will have to take into account the complexities of what happens within that particular jurisdiction. For example, if you take the metros, your city of Cape Town, your Joburg, there may well be sound reasons as to why you need one or two or three. And that is the reason if you look at some of the amendments we are putting here, we are saying, for example, if you look across the board, that requirement which required for each jurisdiction of a district municipality to have a VAB, we are doing away with it. To say that it may be much more based on the dynamics of that particular province, for example, Mpumalanga or Limpopo, rather than because in Limpopo you've got five district municipalities, you have five VABs. It might be because the number of valuation issues which come there, whether it's by way of objections or appeals, one valuation appeal board within that particular province. It may be necessary so they can have one for the whole of Limpopo, so you don't have a number of things. But when you talk about your metros, is the extent to which the things will be happen. What is legislated is a minimum of one, for example, for each of the metropolitan municipalities. Then the other things, it will have to be on the need. Without having to preempt the other discussions which will be coming on, for example, there is a proposal from the South African Institute of Valuers that if you talk about the automatic objection process, which have to revert to the DEP, we need to increase that threshold from 10% to 20%. And that, as a department, we are not opposed to that particular proposal. So some of the things, actually, it takes some of these things out as well to some extent. So that, in a nutshell, is that. Now, coming to the issues of ratios as well, let us be clear that at this particular point, regardless of what may happen or not happen in future, in terms of that which is being regulated by way of ratios, I think it's only three property categories: is agriculture, is the public service infrastructure, and those properties which are owned by PBOs. So it's three. If you talk about commerce and businesses, those are not there. Are not there, but I understand that it might be a fear from municipalities or even SALGA to some extent that may happen in the near future. But even if it happens, when you talk about those ratios, those is by way of regulation. So municipalities and SALGA fit into that particular process. So it's not something where the two ministers sit and do something without a process of public participation on those, because we regard that as something which is critical. Now, there is one other thing which I need to contextualize so that it doesn't also create problems. When you talk to the issue of the regional service council levies, which were abolished, the reason national government abolished those is because constitutional issues started coming up, which it was quite clear that we were not going to win on the basis of that, because those RSC levies were tantamount to some of the things which are happening in the Income Tax Act, which our constitution does not allow. However, there are two things which happen which need to be contextualized. It's not that municipalities lost that revenue which emanated from RSC levies. First, as an interim measure, a grant replacement based on what municipalities were getting was introduced, so municipalities were compensated for that. Now, the second aspect in terms of metros they themselves, we introduced as national government the issue of metros having to share in the general fuel levy. Before then, that instrument, it was only national government and provinces which were sharing. We brought municipalities, metros into that. It's only the rest of the municipalities, so that is district and locals, which are still dependent on the grant replacement. So it's not that there is this revenue gap which was created out of that particular process, which municipalities needed to offset by issues of rates. Likely, and Veronica may come back on the thing, the issue of modeling in terms of the PSI, we need to make things clear so that we are not caught up on the numbers. When we talked about the information which Veronica talked about, it was the issue of the global picture in terms of that particular financial year we looked at. When you go to individual municipalities, what happens within the city of Cape Town may differ with what is happens with Itakwini. So you can't have a common percentage across the board. So it was a global thing, but also the issue of which financial year you are taking into account. Even amongst metros, it will differ, but those are some of the things. But the critical things are the issue of the reasons which are making us to come with proposals. For example, without us getting ahead of ourselves, although we came with a 3-year phasing in, if there is really a need for us to move to a 5-year in terms of phasing in for that, it's something which, as a department, we won't be too much opposed to it. If the committee will move in that particular direction, because it's to manage this particular process, it's in nobody's interest that we create this huge ditch for municipalities. So those are the high-level kinds of things which we think the rest we can deal with them at a later stage. I don't know, Veronica, if there is anything. Okay, so that is it.
Just some clarity, Madam Chair. I'm very glad to hear that there's been a moving of the position. If you remember the last time you came to committee, we discussed the matter about the appeals board, and I indicated to you the difficulties municipalities were having. So I'm glad there's been some consideration. At the time, you said that there was no movement on that one, so I'm glad there's been a rethink there. The second thing I want to get clarity on, when you extrapolated PSI from the budgets to come up with your 1%, did you use the current definition that's in the current Act, or did you use the definition that you propose in the amendment bill? I think that's going to be very important to differentiate. So we can start comparing apples with apples, not apples with pears. So I would hope that it's the same definition that's been used across the board. And then just lastly, I just want to pick up on something very interesting that you said, and I'm glad you said it, and that's that the circumstances, and stop me if I've got you wrong, the circumstances in the city of Cape Town differ from the city of Durban and the city of Tshwane. If I can ask then, if that is the case, why are we trying to impose a standardization of categories if circumstances differ from city to city? And we're acknowledging that there's that difference. Why are we not allowing cities to, given the differences that you've highlighted before committee today, why are we trying to impose a centralized set of regulations given the differences that you've highlighted?
Thank you. On the PSI, when we did the assessment, we used the definition of PSI as it currently is in the Act. So it included all the PSI that is in the Act. And by the way, obviously it differed from municipality to municipality as far as which PSIs they were valuing and rating. They were not necessarily valuing and rating all of it, all of the PSI and so forth, but it is the current definition. We didn't limit it to the PSI that we are talking about. On the differentiation, why are we not differentiating between municipalities? I think it also speaks to the to this discussion where it's been said that we're having a one-size-fits-all approach. I'd like to put it on record that if you look at this bill, it is clear that there are clauses in it which recognize that municipalities are different, that introduce differentiation. We're not discussing them here because they are technical amendments. Once we get into the clause-by-clause process with the committee, you will see that there are those clauses that introduce differentiation. For example, where the reporting requirements may be applicable to certain municipalities and not others, that the minister can determine to which municipalities the reporting requirements apply and so on. So it is not a one-size-fits-all approach. On Section 8, we are not treating all municipalities as if they are the same. Yes, we have said that it is our view in terms of Section 8.2 that those particular categories of property be determined. And it's where applicable, where those properties actually exist in a municipality. If a municipality like Cape Town does not have a mine, it doesn't have to determine, if it doesn't have any mining property, it doesn't have to determine a mining category. So we're not forcing municipalities to determine those. But if those property categories actually exist in those municipalities, then those property categories must be determined. It only makes sense. The third part of Section 8.3, which is being misunderstood, Chairperson, that section is actually saying we recognize subsection 8, subsection 3. That section actually says we recognize that beyond these categories of property that we say should be determined if they actually exist in municipalities, we understand that there may be others, other property categories that don't fit into those property categories that we say should be determined in Section 8.2. So in respect of that, those property categories can also be determined. So all we're saying is that the property categories that are being determined in subsection 3, they recognize the differences between municipalities. We understand that there are specific specialized properties or property categories that may exist in one corner of the country in a certain municipality and another set in another. And section 8.3 actually recognizes that. I want to also put it on record that initially when this bill was published, Chairperson, Section 8 was a lot tighter than it is looking right now. We had a number of engagements with the municipalities sitting around this table here right now. Section 8 did not provide for Section 8.3, which allows for municipal discretion to determine other property categories which do not duplicate the ones that we are saying should be determined in Section 8.2. We have relaxed that. We recognize, and we are not here in the business of usurping the powers of municipalities to determine property categories. No, we're not. What we're trying to do, as we indicated initially, is that we need to be able to monitor what the property category that is being determined is and what rate is applicable. As things currently stand, we're not able to because Section 8 is open-ended. It is open to duplication, and it is open to all sorts of other mechanisms in terms of which property categories can be determined, which even duplicate other property categories. So we did concede, we changed Section 8 drastically, and we provided for Section 8.3. That is why Section 8.3 looks the way it does. So it means differentiation has been recognized, and we recognize that there may be other categories of property besides the ones that we are determining. Mizi also said that we also want to introduce equity and fairness. If you have a government property, by the way, we're not protecting government properties by even introducing public service purposes. Our view is that we are introducing a framework which uses use and permitted use as a framework for determining property categorization. Our view is that just because a property is owned by government, it doesn't mean that it should, by virtue of it being owned by government, it should be excluded completely or be granted an extensive rebate. No, we're saying if a property is owned by anybody, regardless of who it's owned by, we should apply the use or permitted use categorization. If it's a government property and it's a residential property, it should be rated at the same rate as any other residential property which is owned by somebody else. That is what we are trying to do in here. We're not usurping municipal power, and we have introduced elements of differentiation. Thank you, Chair.
Just to add one little thing to contextualize this issue around Section 8. We have, as part of our monitoring, for example, come across a municipality which decided to have a property category for state-owned properties, in which it was charging state four times than what it's charging commercial properties, for example. And those are the inequities which we think it should not be applicable. So we are saying treat everybody the same. And that is the reason I can't go into what she has already tried to explain at details about Section 8.3, which also earlier on I linked it to Section 8 subsection 2 subsection I in terms of if there are certain constraints. But all what we are saying is let municipalities deal with the issues they need to deal with, but we can't, for heaven's sake, have a municipality somewhere sitting deciding to make, for example, state a cash cow which creates problems for a number of things. So deal with everything, put all owners or property categories which are similar, deal with them similarly. That is what for Section 8 we are trying to achieve as government. We have moved away as government, all of us, whether it's public works or national treasury. That is the reason, and we engage with the thing as part of the executive process, cabinet process, that let the state, like anybody else, be treated the same. So that is the purpose we are introducing. We got Section 8 as it is. But we can't have this other tinkering which happened, which creates inequities in the process. So that is all around Section 8.
Thanks.
No, you know why I'm saying
sorry. I understand. but that's why we're sitting on this side. And I did want to add when my colleague was talking, but I was disciplined. Honorable Chair, allow me to submit respectfully that it actually is about the numbers. You cannot talk race if you're not talking numbers. Now, to suggest that, in fact, we must have this discussion and not talk numbers and leave it at a global level means that we're not talking race, we're talking general policy. Truth is, we're talking numbers. So for government to say, no, this is not about the numbers, if I use the quote, let's not be caught up in the numbers. Truth is, we are caught up in the numbers because the numbers are in our budgets. And when you make decisions that are in our budgets, please allow us to talk about the numbers. The second point I thought I should make is this argument that, in fact, when we say that we should prescribe ratios, but that only a set number of categories are accommodated in relation to ratios, and that the others are not accommodated, then the Act should be prescriptive. So you can't leave it, and then we wake up one day and subordinate legislation present something different. So if you say we're introducing it in the definition and we're leaving it in the definition, what do you want to do with the definition? Unless you say we're defining it without the intention of actually it being covered in subordinate legislation, and if there is anything introduced in relation to ratios, this shall be subject to amendment of the Act, then that is very specific. We know what we're talking about. But if you leave it open, then we don't know what we're talking about. And let me submit respectfully that we've had many experiences where things were left ambiguous and subordinate legislation comes and it gives us all sorts of things that were not anticipated. Now, we want the Act to be very clear. It says these are the categories, these are the ratios if you want to prescribe, so that we can argue like we're arguing here to say we think that provision of ratios is inappropriate. But to leave it to say, well, that's not the intention, then if it's not the intention, it must be clear that it is not the intention. And the Act must be specific that only these categories shall be provided for in relation to ratios, so that we don't leave it as an ambiguous provision. It must be very clear what you're trying to do. Now, I think it's important to clarify, and it's important particularly when we're dealing with COCT, to say, even with the introduction of the, with the scrapping of the RSC levies, we brought it to the attention in particular of DPLG then, what the impact on our city would be. The introduction of the grant had a direct budget implication. So there was a reduction in the income of the city of Johannesburg. Fact. It's not an assumption. Fact. The replacement of the grant with the fuel levy had a further impact on the budget of the city of Johannesburg. That is not an assumption. Fact. Now, it doesn't mean that if you say we've introduced alternatives, that those alternatives do not have implications. And I'm not arguing, in fact, that other municipalities might not have benefited positively. It's not true. In fact, other municipalities might have benefited positively. But the reality is, because we speak about these matters and not relate to the numbers, we're saying, well, those that are affected by the numbers must keep quiet because it's a general principle. But we're saying, as a matter of fact, the impact has been negative. And the truth is, we've had to shift that tax burden to the residents of Johannesburg. There's nothing else we could do. So we've had to shift that. And that's why we're presenting here to say, we don't think that the residents, in particular, in our city, can take a further burden on tax. Because, in fact, if you do an impact assessment on the pocket of the household, we have been putting the household under enormous pressure over the past 5 to 10 years, simply with the introduction of new legislation. And we can go on and on. And please, COCTA should at least be the ones that understand this. We can talk about ARDO and the implications of ARDO in our budget. So we can go on about the list of interventions at the legislative level that have impacted directly on our budget. And we are here respectfully, Honorable Chair, to say we've reached the point where we can't go back to the residents and say, cough up more. That's all we're submitting respectfully. We can't go back unless there is an intention that it would be covered from somewhere else. If there is that intention should be clarified. Okay. Lastly, Chair, we publish, as per the MPRA, rates policies as municipalities. All ratepayers, including government, are entitled to comment. All ratepayers. There's no ratepayer who doesn't see annually what the rates policy is. We wouldn't have rates policies. You can't write rates policies in the Act. The Act provided for the rates policy so that we can, in a transparent manner, indicate to the ratepayer, this is what the rate policy intends, this is how it would operate, these are the categories, these are the intentions, these are the policy objectives, because in many instances, decisions about where you shift the burden of tax is also a policy decision. In fact, it's a political decision. To say, no, The shift in the tax burden to this category is intended to relieve either the residents and place a burden on business for these reasons, or we're shifting from this category so that we incentivize economic activity. So there are different policy decisions that are made from time to time to determine. Those are determined by objective conditions on the ground. Now, to suggest that, in fact, you're taking away that responsibility from the political office bearers who are elected to be able to articulate what the policy objective is, I think is a problem. But I would have thought that the reason you said in the Act that there must be a race policy is so that our policy objectives are transparent. And if there's a problem, any person has a right to object, like we receive objections all the time. Now, one of the things, for example, we're very clear about, and the city evaluator is here, we're very clear about the fact that the principle of ensuring that the city evaluator is not subjected to political pressure is a very important principle. Now, and why I'm emphasizing that principle here is because you don't want the city evaluator to worry about the budget. You want the city valuer to worry about values as determined in terms of the valuations process. And that principle you must maintain. But if you work on the basis of that principle, then you allow the political process to manage the policy so that you separate the valuations process from the policy. But the risk of, in fact, seeking to prescribe every single detail is that, in fact, you are now prescribing to the valuer what they must. And that, on its own, presents difficulties. I think the issue of appeal boards, we'll always debate it. I mean, we think that there's a problem, but my colleagues can talk about that. Thank you very much. Can I allow my colleagues to add one or two things?
No, because of time.
Oh, okay.
It's because of time. Let's throw the discussion in the basket, and then we'll, when time goes on, we'll pick them up. For discussion, for further discussion before the finalization of the paper. I'll now give over to Ethekwini Municipality.
Thank you, Chair. We thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. Much of what we're going to present has already been said, but we're going to say it anyway. Much of Ethekwini's proposed amendments to the MPRA much of the proposed amendments to the MPRA are welcomed, and we want to make that clear that a lot of it we actually agree with and we welcome it. However, from Ethekwini Municipality, we just want to comment on a few amendments which have already been highlighted in this forum. Our written submission deals with the bill more comprehensively, but we just want to highlight these issues that I'm going to highlight today. I want to take you back a little bit to the white paper on local government. I think it's important because the white paper laid down the policy principle that enabled local government to raise local revenue, and it was our enabling legislation. And to quote from the white paper, the choice of tax rate is the most critical means of promoting the fiscal autonomy of local government. The freedom of municipalities to vary the tax rate strengthens local accountability and enables communities to challenge municipalities about the value for money of services provided. It goes on to state that national legislation must provide a framework within which local taxation policy must fit. Then we have Section 229 of the Constitution, which empowers a municipality to raise rates, and we have Section 2 of the MPRA, which gives effect to this provision. And we see in the preamble of the MPRA that it recognizes that there's a need to provide local government with access to a source of revenue necessary to fulfill its developmental responsibilities. And that income is derived from property rates, and it's a critical source of revenue for all municipalities to achieve their constitutional objectives. And we find that this amendment bill overrides the power given to municipalities in that it is too prescriptive. I will discuss this a little more in detail as I go along. But first, I want to explain the concepts of use, category of property, and category of owner, because I feel that COCTA is blurring the lines between use, category of property, and category of owner. Now, in terms of Section 8.1, the municipality may determine its category of property using the concept of use, permitted use, or geographic area. None of the municipalities use geographic area for obvious reasons. A rate randage is applied to each of the categories of property that we determine. That will be 1 cent in a rand or point whatever cents in a rand. That's a rate randage to each of those categories. Then we have Section 15 of the Act, which introduces categories of owners. And when we have a category of owner, we apply exemptions, rebates, and reductions to each of the category of owner. So we separate use from ownership, category of property from category of owner. And this distinction is very important. Just by way of example, we have a building that is situated in a residential area that is zoned for residential, but it's owned by a doctor who uses it for his doctor's surgery. Now, this is very common. The zoning or permitted use is residential, but his actual use is business. If the municipality uses permitted use to determine its category of property, then the property will fall into the residential category because it's zoned residential. If the municipality uses actual use to determine its category of property, then the property will be rated as a business because he's using it as a doctor's surgery, which is a business. Now, these scenarios are in terms of Section 8.1 of the Act, and it's logical, it's simple, and it's accepted by all the municipalities. The confusion, however, comes in with Section 8.2 when it introduces ownership in determining the category of property. So if we look at our example of the doctor and his doctor's surgery, the doctor becomes a category of property. Property is owned by doctors. So you attach a rate randage to properties owned by doctors. And we think this is absurd because now you're blurring that line. In fact, the doctor should fall into the Section 15 category of owner so that he can attract an exemption, rebate, or reduction in the rates. Now, I heard from COCTA that we should, and I was very happy about this, that we should keep these lines separate. We should distinguish between ownership and use and category of property. And while they're saying it out here, it's not in the Act because if you look at Section 8.2 of the amendments, they say a municipality must determine the following categories. And F says property is owned by an organ of state. H says property owned by PBO or public benefit organizations. So that distinction is not made. And we're saying please keep these concepts clear and free from ambiguity. Now, having explained the important concepts of category of property and category of owner, I just want to go into Section 8.2. While Section 8 serves as a guide to municipalities, and I emphasize it's a guide to municipalities in formulating its rates policies and identifying categories of properties based on every municipality's unique social, environmental, and financial environment, we feel that the bill takes away all discretion a municipality may exercise, in that the bill makes it mandatory that the rates policy must be determined according to the listed categories, which are limited. And I agree with my colleague in SALGA. There's no discretion because Section 8.2 says a municipality must determine the following categories of rateable property in terms of subsection 1, and it lists the categories of properties which must be determined. Again, we say that each municipality is different and has different needs. That informs its rates policy. Again, I agree with my colleagues in the city of Joburg. Our rates policies are open for public participation. It's therefore a transparent policy. So where COCTA argues there's no transparency, I don't see how that could be because each rates policy goes through a transparent process. Itikweni, for example, has no need for mining category, just like Cape Town. They have no need for a mining category because we've got no mines in our jurisdiction. It's therefore absurd for us to carry this category in our policy and attach a rate randage to this category because it's meaningless. Because Section 8.2 says a municipality must determine. On the other hand, the municipality can use its flexibility to create categories in accordance with its demographics. I give you another example. Itikweni had the vacant land category, and we attached a rate randage to this category, vacant land. And this rate randage was high compared to all the other categories. because it was in line with our IDP, and we wanted to encourage development and discourage land banking. So we attached a very high rate randage to vacant land. And then we found that the outlying areas of our municipality remained undeveloped, not because they were land banking, but because we won't approve their plans, because we couldn't get services, we couldn't get water and electricity to the outlying areas, so we wouldn't approve their plans for development. So it went contrary to what we had originally intended. So this is where our flexibility came in, and we introduced a new category of property called development phasing line. And all the vacant property within this line, that's all the outlying areas, attracted a lower rate randage. And this is how we overcome what our IDP wanted and what was intended and what happened on the ground. And it is this kind of sophistication that local government needs. And this can only be developed by the local municipality itself. It cannot be legislated. Where our legislator, COCTA in particular, states that the new, the bill brings certainty, where the old bill didn't, the act currently didn't have certainty. We now grew up with this act. And I want you to draw your attention to the case of, and this is an appeal case, Blom versus City of Shwane. It's another example where the courts have accepted the right of the municipality to determine its category of property. In this case, an attorney was using his residential home to run his attorney's practice. And he ignored all the planning notices that was served on him. And the municipality couldn't rate him under the categories they had. So they introduced a category of property in their rates policy, which was the illegal use and unauthorized use category. The attorney in court argued that the municipality is limited to the categories as stated in Section 8.2, and that's the current act. But the Court of Appeal accepted that Section 8.2 was merely a guide, and that the municipality could determine its own categories of property. And I'm saying to you, if we already have that certainty from a court case and the courts have accepted it, why now not overturn that certainty and try and over-regulate? Going back a step, having earlier explained the concept of category of property that attracts the rate randage and category of owner that attracts the exemption, rebates, and reductions, we want to point out the confusion created in 8.2 when it introduces ownership like state-owned properties and properties owned by public benefit organizations. At Itikweni Municipality, if we apply the ratio of 1:1 to PSI and the public benefit organizations, there would be a huge shift in incidence. While the PSI and PBO category would benefit by a reduction of 88.4%. All the other categories and across the board, not only residential, but across the board, increases by 5.4%. For our municipality, where 75% of our residential property is valued under 750,000, this means that the poor and the middle income earners bear the brunt of the increase in rates. I must stress that no study was done by the Department of Cooperative Government on the impact of the bill. Yes, a study was done in terms of the current act, but not in terms of the bill and the shift in incidence, because the current definition is much wider. I know, and I speak on connection, and I've been hearing from my colleagues, that Shwane has a shift of incidence of 3.4%. City of Joburg around 3.4, Nelson Mandela Metropolitan 4.5, and City of Cape Town 4.2% shift in incidence. And these shifts are huge and has a huge impact on our budgets. If we look at public service purposes, it has hospitals, schools, libraries, police stations, prisons, courts of law, etc., etc. These are all national and provincial competencies, which now our residents are expected to pay for. And with respect, this amounts to double taxation because they're already paying to the fiscus, and now they must pay out of their property rates as well to supplement national and provincial government. We must also understand that municipalities have zero-based budgets. So if we give to one category, we have to take away from another. We don't make a profit, so we have to pass the buck on to another category. Unfortunately, it's our poorest residents who suffer because they are now taxed out of their homes. We understand that the bill is trying to regulate delinquent municipalities by introducing or forcing the acceptance of a set of categories. But we say to you that Section 8.2 is certainly not the place. Deal with the delinquent municipalities separately. And if you make the distinction between use and ownership, then you would not have the problem of municipalities putting state-owned properties as a category of property, because it's ownership. The reporting that was introduced by the bill is where delinquent municipalities must be dealt with. We welcome the reporting because we feel that these delinquent municipalities would be forewarned if they're not compliant. To step away from Section 8, we welcome the changes that the bill brings to Section 78 because this will indeed make our work more efficient. But we would like to propose three other amendments, if I may, that are not in the bill. The first is an amendment to the definition of owner, and my colleagues at CELGA have dealt with this in more detail. We would like the deletion of or whom it was granted to in terms of legislation, and again, CELGA has expanded on this. The reason is that the definition of owner states that the municipality must recognize a right in land. We have no problems with registered rights, because registered rights are registered in the deeds office and there's proper control of properties. And the courts also recognize and accept ownership if it is registered in the deeds office. We do have a problem with the unregistered rights. The second amendment is to the definition of property, and we want the deletion of or granted to a person in terms of legislation for the same reasons that I discussed earlier. And our third amendment is to Section 28 of and 29 of the Property Rates Act, where the municipality may recover rates in arrears from tenants, occupiers, or agents of the owner. Now this, in Cuadaguza municipality, I'll give you that example. There was a shopping mall where the landowner, owner A, owned the land, and the developer was B. So the owner of the property was A and had nothing to do with the developer, who was B. But all the tenants in this mall had their lease agreements with the developer, who was B. Now this mall, shopping mall, a huge shopping mall, owned a good few million in arrear rates. And the municipality, in accordance with Section 28 and 29, attached the rentals from the tenants. And their argument in court, a technical argument, was that we don't owe the rates to the owner, any money to the owner. We owe it to the developer because they signed the leases with the developer. So we just want a little bit of an amendment to state that, to include to the owner, third party, or the lessor, if such third party or lessor is not the owner. I'm not sure if my colleague, Keith Mathias, we're both here presenting to you today, and we're both available to answer your questions. Thank you very much.
You want to add, or we are done?
Chair, thank you for the space granted us over the last three, or the coming 3 days. It's really appreciated. I think I'd just like to make a couple of comments in amplification of what previous speakers and what Fatima has said. The fact that you've got so many municipalities here today is testament of the concerns that municipalities have with regards to certain of the proposals, in particular amendments to 8. I think history is informing us of those concerns. Whilst ratios are not being spoken about as they publish through regulation. We do have experience in terms of what has previously been proposed in terms of ratios and what the impacts can be. And it's based on those concerns that in Itsekweni's case, we've quoted that 5.4% impact. I think the concern is, and you're hearing that coming through quite clearly from past speakers, is that is the amendments to this Act really designed to shelter a particular group of ratepayers? And if that is the case, then it means there's going to be a shift onto the others, as has been said. And I think that is one of the real concerns. I'd like to leave on a positive point, though. I do need to give credibility and thanks for a lot of the changes that have been proposed, which are welcomed. Thank you.
Thanks. At least you've done a bit of my work. At the end, I was supposed to summarize on what transpired through all the presentations. So you've done the work for me. Members, here's the presentation. I recognize Honorable Bonhomme. Over to you.
Madam Chair, I just need a little clarification to understand it more clearer. You said high rate randage to vacant land at the development phase in the line, lower rate randage to land. Now, I just want to understand, is the rate being reduced? If it is reduced, then aren't you encouraging land hoarding and opening more space for land evasion and informal settlements?
I'm sorry about that. I'm reminded about keeping on time. members, is there any questions? If none, department, do you want to come in?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm assuming that the question asked by the member will be responded to by Itsekweni, but from our side, we're not introducing any shifts in rate randages, and we're not tinkering with any increase in any rate randages. This is an amendment that doesn't deal with cent amounts on the rand. So I'm assuming that that is specific to the comment that Itsekweni made. I just want to comment on a couple of things, not to open too much of a debate, but on because we all know, it's quite clear that there are differences between our approach and what the municipalities feel. And at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the committee to take everything on board and make a considered decision about what is best for the country, not best for one municipality or one group of municipalities, but best for all municipalities, all ratepayers, not just specific ratepayers, all property categories, not just specific property categories, and for national and provincial government and the country as a whole. So we need to look at it. We need to look at it holistically. We need to look at it from a global perspective, from a country perspective. Although we do look at individual municipal cases, we look at every municipality, but at the end of the day, we need to escalate it to the aggregate as well and look at what's best for the country. Just on some comments that have been made by Itsekweni, which I must comment on, that we are introducing ownership in the property categorization framework. It's quite clear in Section 8 that we, and it's been agreed with municipalities, and even Itsekweni said so now, that use and permitted use are the drivers for property categorization. That's agreed. We agree with that, and we feel that that is appropriate. We don't feel that, in general, property categorization should be based on ownership. However, in certain instances, you have to recognize elements of ownership. And because we realize that, we have combined use and ownership in two specific property categories.
We are transparent about that. We're upfront. Those are PBO properties and public service purposes. Public service purpose property, by its very nature, it's those properties are owned by the state. They can't be owned by anybody else. We want to make it clear that we're talking about state properties, and we've already said that we are not wanting to exempt the state from paying rates. We want to recognize that those are property categories. And we introduce it by also saying that they are used for the provision of those public services that are mentioned in there. For PBO-type properties, or what is called properties owned by public benefit organization and used for specific public benefit activities, that, by the way, is not a new property category. We're not introducing it. If you look at the Act as it currently is, that property category has been there all along. Now, the reason that ownership is involved is because we're talking about public benefit organizations and the activities that they undertake, which might mirror some of the activities that are undertaken by the state. They're usually NGOs. They're doing some activities that would normally be undertaken by the state. And they've been specified here so that municipalities can recognize that those PBOs actually undertake those specific activities. It's not a new property category. It's been there all along. We've inserted it because it's an existing property category. We're not introducing ownership. Ownership here is coupled with use, because our key driver for property categorization, as we said in Section 8, is use, and it's permitted use. So it's a misnomer to say that we are, we're going against what we are saying and using ownership as the driver for property categorization. We are not. The second thing that I would like to indicate is that we understand what the white paper for local government says. The point that was made was that the choice of tax rate is the municipality's choice. That is true. The municipality determines the cent amount in the rand for each of the property categories. We are not tinkering with that. We cannot sit here and say you must charge X cent amount in the rand for Y property category. We're not allowed to. The Act doesn't allow us to do that. Hence, we are not treading on that ground, which is a municipal function. It's a municipal. It's the authority of the municipality to do that. Section 229 of the Constitution, we recognize that. And in fact, this bill actually recognizes that we must undertake our actions, or whatever our mandate is, being mindful of that section of the Constitution. The Act is a framework which actually gives, if you look at Section 229 of the Constitution, it does say that the municipality does have authority to levy rates on property, but that authority can be regulated by legislation. And the legislation that Parliament introduced to regulate that authority of a municipality is the Municipal Property Rates Act that we're amending today. And we're amending it within the constraints of the Constitution. The State Law Advisor is sitting here with us. They did vet this piece of legislation. They must vet a piece of legislation before it even goes to Cabinet, in terms of whether it is legal and whether it is constitutional. That process has been done. In fact, the bill has been vetted twice for constitutionality. First, when it went to Cabinet, when we published it for public comments, and secondly, when we went to Cabinet so that Cabinet can introduce it to Parliament. It has been vetted for that. The State Law Advisor can attest to that. I wanted to clarify those two things. A third thing that I'd like to clarify is the issue of whether ratios are going to be determined, and that municipalities will be more comfortable if they know at the outset whether ratios are going to be determined. Chairperson, with respect, I must say we cannot say in a primary piece of legislation right now that, okay, we are determining this property category, so this means that we are going to determine a ratio for it. In fact, the Property Rates Act as it currently is, right now as we look at it, when it was passed as a framework of an act which gives national government the authority to regulate rating by municipalities. If you look at Section 19, it actually indicated that, I'm going to read it quickly, a rate on non-residential properties that exceed the prescribed rate ratio to the rate on residential properties determined in terms of Section 111A, provided that different ratios may be set in respect of different categories of residential properties. It means that a municipality may not levy a rate that is higher than a ratio which is determined. That is a clause in the Act which presents a framework in terms of which this national legislation may determine ratios if it so pleases. That is already in the Act. The Act doesn't provide, we cannot in the Act say, yes, we are going to determine a ratio for business, yes, we're going to determine a ratio for a certain category of property. The Act already provides that ratios may be determined in terms of this legislation. So it is, I just want to clarify that it's a bit, it's difficult for us to do that at this stage because the Act doesn't allow us to determine here that if a certain category of property is determined, there will be a ratio, whether there is an intention to do that. I know that there's a lot of fear that there may be a ratio that could apply to a category of property such as public service purposes. However, when the Act was first introduced, that fear was already there because the Act already provided in Section 19 that ratios may be set for categories of property. Chairperson, I'll stop there and ask maybe to respond to the others that I haven't responded to.
Just to assist the committee, because most of what Itekwin was saying, it ran through from what Salga and the City of Joburg were saying. And quite we understand why all of them, they got the consensus, so they are municipalities. So in a nutshell, they are likely to see things the same way. But if just to underline the fact that so that if we generalize things, we end up not being in a position to deal with specific issues. If you look at Section 8, Subsection 2, like what Veronica was saying, there are only two property categories there, and we have been upfront, even when we briefed the committee earlier regarding the issue of public service purposes. And those are the only two issues which we have put there, and even today we even gave the reasons as to why they are there. It's not everything where we are blurring the issue, blurring the lines between ownership and use, but the issue is whether the committee will like it. So we just need to submit that we have been clear upfront as to what is only two. And for that reason, we have provided. But secondly, also, the issue, the colleague from Itekwin, I understand, it was just an oversight on her part. If she should have read carefully what subsection 8, subsection 2 says, and I'll read it verbatim. It says a municipality must determine the following categories of rateable property in terms of subsection 1. Underline the following. Provided such property category exists within the municipal jurisdiction. So if you don't have a mining in a particular property category, it's neither here nor there. It's only if those things are there. So I'm just saying this when, so that when the committee comes to the issue of this particular section, those things are taken into account. And we'll welcome that discussion as we have stated for those two particular property categories as to whether it makes sense or not. But outside of those, we are clear that we are not creating any other things which will create a confusion. Thanks.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I hear what you're saying, but I think that the problem is lying here with the language of the bill, and perhaps committee is going to have to work on that when we do clause by clause. Because I think the problem that's coming in here is to do with the word must. Because if one then looks at subsection 3, it said there, provided that with the exception of vacant land, the determination of such property categories does not circumvent the categories of rateable properties that must be determined. So you're saying that these are the categories that must be determined. Not may be determined, should be determined, can be determined. You're prescribing by using the word must. So I think there's a language problem, and I think that we're going to have to deal with that when we when we get to that section of the bill and we start dealing with the technicalities there. But I can see where the municipalities are coming from and when they're saying it's prescribed, and I think it's around the language. I mean, I just want to have an understanding. But I mean, we all understand we pay tax, and we all must pay our share. And what happens in instances where something's declared public service infrastructure? And I'll give you an example. In the Natal Mercury this morning, Natal Witness this morning on the aeroplane, there's a story about a government-owned property on the Berea in Durban. It's owned by government. It's fallen into disrepair. The municipality has had to put security guards there. It's had to go and clean up and that there. And you're now going to remove an opportunity for them to raise rates there. So it looks like we're shifting huge obligations onto municipalities and taking away rights from them at the same time. I also, just want to have, go back here, because one of the things that we spoke about earlier was that some municipalities aren't rating PSI. There's something that aren't rating it. And in our discussions with the FFC during last year or near the end of last year, there was discussion on how we can enhance the revenue raising ability of local government and looking at alternative streams. Now, would you not say that if these municipalities are actually losing out because they're not rating these properties, and that what we should be doing is assisting them as a department to be able to conduct that rating properly so they're able to bring in a greater share of of rates income? Everybody, the thing about taxes is that everybody must pay their due. And I hear what you're saying about, government comes and puts a police station and, the community should be very grateful and then, just exempt them from rates, etc. But, I mean, there's lots of other, if you take that argument to its logical conclusion, we're going to run into problems because we have a shortage of graduates in the country. You could then say that a varsity college, is providing a great service to the community because they are producing graduates for South Africa to deal with the graduate crisis in the country, and therefore we should exempt them from paying tax. And so I think if you start using that principle, it's problematic. But I do want to ask you a question. Given the fact that we're shown now that under the new definition, the incidence rate of shifting burden onto residential and business ratepayers by government exempting itself with that shift of incidence, I mean, does the department accept that taxpayers, the ratepayers, are going to have to pick up that shortfall? Because we've heard from the municipality, there's no municipality, I think, in the country, and we've travelled around, that is able to meet its current obligations with its current budget. In fact, many municipalities are battling to even, provide the most basic of service delivery, water and electricity, given the current budget constraints. And, are we not, by going through this and forcing them to cut their budget to meet it, are we not going to hamper service delivery? And B, if they're not going to cut their budget, they're going to have to, find this money from somewhere else. It's got to come from somewhere. Do you accept that burden is going to fall onto residential and business ratepayers and increase their rates burden? Or is there a third way out that I can't see?
Just quickly on what the honourable member was saying.
Thanks, Jim. Just for interest's sake, and I know it may not be in this department, this program may not have the answers. But outstanding debt to municipalities, what percentage of that is rates? And what percentage is services? And we know about the history thereof, we know about the questions around where there's some challenges around discrepancies and so on that have not yet been sorted out. But is there do we have a percentage of outstanding debt which is related to rates and which is related to services? And then the department also speaks about phasing in once this amendment has gone through this approach. What in your mind would happen to the outstanding debt that is still owed to municipalities? Thanks, Chair.
Before I forget, let me quickly come on the first set of questions which were raised. Well, unfortunately, the information which is required, we don't have it with us here, but some of our colleagues in the department may have it. That information, the National Treasury and some of our colleagues who deal with those issues may have them. Now, the other thing... Well, I'm not so sure, hence I'm saying, I'm not so sure whether they will have it or may not have it. But coming to the issue as to what will happen if there has been outstanding debt when the issue of PSI is excluded from rating. Now, whatever anybody shall have been liable for municipalities until a change in policy, those people will have to pay. So it doesn't take away whatever obligations which was there, because it can be retrospective as to what happened earlier on. Now, coming to the issue of two things. One, the issue of PSI, that given that we said a number of municipalities chose not to rate PSI, that was their prerogative. And based on what we said, that we felt in our view that actually it was not appropriate for PSI to have been included in the PSI. And when municipalities took that particular decision, for us, it in a way, it was starting to take into account the significance of PSI. So that is the reason we didn't see it as a problem for PSI per se. But also, like, I'm not so sure whether it has been raised, but it may be that right at the outset, what municipalities actually, after the act was put into place in the first instance, some of them indicated that the issue of PSI having been brought in here, it just created problems from valuation perspective, because the act at that stage required PSE to be valued whether municipalities want to rate or not. You'll recall at a later stage we made an amendment to the act where we took away that requirement that for PSI, if you don't have an intention to liberate, there is no need to value. So the mere fact that an obligation was put in municipalities to value, then you are creating cost consideration for them, and that is why some of them may have been compelled to start rating in that particular way. Now, the second issue about this issue of shift in incidence, it's more of an issue of a chicken and egg if you take the country as a whole. Because truly, when you talk about the fact if you exempt or exclude certain properties from rating, that it may well be that the residents within that particular municipality may end up having to bear that cost if the budget is not cut, like His Worship, the mayor of the city of Johannesburg, indicated. But on the other hand, if the state itself, Joburg, has to foot the bill itself, then again, it has got an impact as to how much of the funding from the central fiscus, when the budget is done, will go back to municipalities through the local government equitable share or anything else, because those considerations will have to be taken. However, I must concede that, like I said, it may not affect municipalities the same, but there is that particular, because there is nothing like free license. The government has to pay for these particular properties. Where does it pay for? So either the income taxes, where most of this revenue which the state is using to fund national government and provincial government, as well as making contributions to municipalities by way of conditional grants, including your MIG, as well as the unconditional grants of the local government equitable share, it might well be that the growth in terms of that share which they were supposed to get or government, so there would always be those particular things. It's only that in that particular case, somebody may argue that the burden has shifted from particular people in a particular municipal jurisdiction to all income taxpayers throughout the country. So there will always be that. So it's just an issue as to where it comes from. So hence, I said it's slightly complicated. It's more of a chicken and egg, because one way or another, when the budget is done for the 3 years, it will have those particular things as well. Thanks.
Thanks. Way of concluding, Sevini?
Thank you, Chair. With respect, there is no chicken and egg situation. The Income Tax Act is very distinct from property rates. They're two different acts. And I think that is where COGTA falls short, in that they try to marry the two acts, but they're not the same. And they do it, we see it with public benefit organizations, where they try to marry it again, and it's been a disaster. Where public benefit organizations, in terms of the certain sections of the 9 schedule of the Income Tax Act, have to get a quarter of a ratio. And in our municipality, it was the private schools that were affected. We had to rate the private schools, not in terms of our ordinary rating categories, but we were forced to put them into a separate category and give them a quarter of all other residential, a quarter of residential. And what that meant, and by the way, this was in terms of the Income Tax Act, public benefit organizations in terms of the Income Tax Act. And what this meant was that ordinary citizens like you and I, who send our children to ordinary government schools who can't afford fees, have to pay extra in our rates, so that the person sending his kids to the private school get a discount on their property rates. And to us, that was unacceptable, all because government couldn't make the distinction between the Income Tax Act and Property Rates Act. So definitely, there's no chicken and egg situation. Would you like to add? I think that's all from my side. Thank you.
I have to respond on that. I don't want us to have a dialogue about this, but what Etequini is doing is quite mischievous.
That's the main
exercise. Yes, so, but you see, Etequini is blurring the lines, to use their words. What they are mentioning now about public benefit organizations, it is not a creation of COGTA. We need to be clear about statements that we made. We did not create or link public benefit organizations to the Income Tax Act. The legislature did that. These things precede us. This is already in the Property Rates Act. This category of property is already there, and it's linked to the Income Tax Act from that perspective. I didn't link anything to the Income Tax Act. Now, there are reasons that that legislature, through its wisdom, linked the two acts. The reason that they linked the two acts, one of the reasons anyway, is that public benefit organizations, by virtue of their existence, they are set up in terms of Income Tax Act obligations and whether they pay Income Tax Act or not in the Income Tax Act. Now, because the legislature saw it fit to recognize those public benefit organizations from a property rates perspective in this act, and because that the Income Tax Act is from whence they originate, you know, a cross-reference was made. All that is contained in this act, as far as PBO and the Income Tax Act, is a cross-reference around the definition of what public benefit organizations are. So we didn't create that. The act is as it is, and the act provides for those particular property categories. I just had to make that quite clear, Chair.
No, let us not make it there.
Just a final comment. I accept that it wasn't created by COGTA, but the regulations came in much later. Regulations didn't precede that. However, when we look at the amendments, and this is where Itaquini comes in and says, please make the distinction between category of property and category of owner. And that's where the importance comes in, with use and ownership. And we believe that public benefit organizations, if you're going to do an amendment like this, the ownership should come out of it, and we should take ownership and give them an exemption, a reduction, or a rebate.
And that's where it should come in. It shouldn't be regulated to say you get quarter of what we're giving to residential. Because it's not, I use schools as an example, but there's universities who have PBO certificates. They've come to us and we've refused to give it to them. There's private hospitals and a whole lot of private institutions have who have presented public PBO status from SARS. Now, SARS have their own mechanism and they know what why they're giving them these statuses, but that doesn't affect the rates. When we looked at some of these organizations, for example, we saw that the rates that they were paying in terms of the overall budget of that public benefit organization was minuscule. And yet they were demanding a quarter of residential, and the residents have to carry it. And we're saying this is not right. We should make this distinction between ownership and use, property and ownership. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Tegan, for your input. Let me now invite, for the sake of time, the Institute for Municipal Finance officers.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Honorable members of Parliament, unfortunately, our president is still on her way, but I'm going to deal with this because we were supposed to start at 2 o'clock. When we look at the Institute of Municipal Finance Officers, that's an organization that was created in 1929. It's a non-profit company. It plays a constructive role in local government finance policy formulation, and it's got as one of its legs the Valuation and Rating Forum. And both Mr. Christopher Gavore, who's a professional valuer, and myself are attending on the basis of the Valuation and Rating Forum. I would like to break this submission that we've made to you already, the written submission, into two components. The one, it's got a negative financial impact, and the other one, a negative impact on municipal budgets. And Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of Parliament, we must understand the negative financial impact that sits in this bill on local government. But before I get onto the negatives, let's deal with the positives. The Municipal Property Rights Act, when it was promulgated in 2005, was already an excellent piece of legislation in terms of the ordinances that we had before that time. The amendment that's in front of you is taking that a step further, a couple of steps further. And we do appreciate the interaction between IMFO, the Institute, and COCTA, National Treasury, SOLGA, SA Cities Network, etc., in dealing with these matters. One of our successes was, and you would be aware of that, was the rural development bill that came out in terms of the Valuation Act that they were bringing forward, where they wanted to create the Office of the Valuer General, and that would have taken a lot of work away from local government and would have impacted on this act. Together we withstood that and we made comments to that effect. But getting back into what we believe should be dealt with here, I would like to get to agricultural purposes. Game farming, Honorable Members of Parliament, is a business. People are moving from food security and provision of food to making money. If we look at what some of these animals are going at auctions, you don't even get a farm going at that price. And then they get that for one buffalo. We're talking 18, 20, 26 million rand. And I get very emotional when I go to my poorer customers and saying that you got to pay more rates so that somebody who is wealthy but has got a good cause or a good way of presenting him or herself to actually get a subsidy that you're paying for. So on the agricultural one, the only question that we should ask ourselves today, is it fair that business is subsidized by residential ratepayers? And when I look at residential, yes, you've got a few properties that are worth millions of rands, but the bulk of your residential ratepayers are on the bread and butter side, just too wealthy to be poor. I want to get to public sector, public service infrastructure. Honorable Members of Parliament, you will recall that in 2007, in December, when we were supposed to be on leave, regulations were published that would have given all government properties the rate of 25% of residential. That would have meant, for instance, for the city of Cape Town an 8% wage increase. If I remember the figure correctly, they quoted at that stage 252 million rand, and that is a good couple of years ago. With the involvement of SALGA and of the cities, that was actually stopped, and it was walked away from. Then all of a sudden, we had regulations that came out that dealt with farms, and I think there was one other category. And then I believe it is to do with the court case of the schools in Etiquette that the category of public benefit organization was added. But those things we as municipalities and as info never had further feedback from the department. It came to us as a shocker. Yes, there could be a reason, and we've seen or heard that there was discussions with SALGA. I'm not too certain about that, but the only thing I'm saying is to local government, the people who are picking up the tab and saying to ratepayers, you've got to pay more because we're giving other people a rebate. For those people, it was an impact. We've had a number of discussions with National Treasury and with COCTA to say, why are you creating this category of public service purposes? It does not make any sense unless you want to go back to what you started to do in 2007. And that is one taxpayer giving himself or herself, I don't know whether it's a him or a her, a tax rebate at the expense of others. And ladies and honorable members of parliament, if it was only the 4% or 5% rates increase that it would bring to cut down, that is one thing. But we say there's no improvement in service level when we ask people to pay that amount more because we're subsidizing government. Government accounts are paid 100%. So the cash flow is 100%. It's budget neutral. You don't have to provide for a contribution to your bad debts provision. The moment you move that rates from government into residential and businesses, you're picking up in the well-run municipalities on a 90 to 95% collection rate. So you got anything of 5 to 10% of that, which is not going to come in as cash. Which then means, even if you raise exactly the same money, your service delivery capability will reduce by that unpaid portion of your rates account. And one needs to ask that question, do we want to see that risk? We are concerned from InfoSight, as we look at a number of municipalities who deal with us in the Valuation and Rating Forum, we are very concerned about the impact of what we believe is just ready to happen. It wants to go back to what was in 2007 because we've got precedent. It is not something that's just a figment of our imagination. And I again want to say, honorable members of parliament, it was a regulation that was published in the middle of December when we were supposed to be on leave. When we say to one another, when we reduce service levels and we look at the impact on local government, where are we with a project about clean audits 2014? I know there are quite a number of municipalities. We can see it every year at the info conference. The number of clean audits are increasing. But taking away cash from municipalities is impacting service level, and it's going to impact on our ability to create and to maintain our clean audits. That is something that we are very concerned about. Your clean audits, you've heard from, I think it was from Johannesburg, if you don't have a clean audit or you have a financial problem, it comes into your annual financial statements, it comes into your assessment from people lending your money, your credit rating, and those kind of things tend to then make your credit that you apply for more expensive. So it's just a cost element, the one thing builds on another. We need to understand the financial mechanisms that we're dealing with. A further negative financial implication, the differential rates, and I will touch that on the ratio also. The only thing one needs to understand about a rebate is that you cannot give it away if you haven't taken it from somebody else already. So when you start and you say, we will now prescribe from a national level, where we previously have in the Act, in Section 8, the council may, it is now changing to 8.1 and 8.2, the council must. It removes the rates policy specification on local government circumstances and to solve it. It removes the flexibility of our councillors as well as their accountability
to the right buyers that elected them to actually serve them with something that can be amended. It was also mentioned already that rights policies are serving in front of councils on an annual basis, subject to an intensive public participation process. And where we find that something is not working well, because lo and behold, members of parliament, you have certain people that in terms of your policy, you feel that they should be helped, and they're not being helped, so you need to change your policy. But you also find the shysters, the people who take any chance of making a few bucks as long as somebody else is paying for it, and to make sure that you actually stop those people. And I want to interrupt myself there. When I look at public benefit organizations, yes, it is in the Act. I accept that. But, honorable members of Parliament, we must look at the ability to pay of those organizations. Some of them are sitting on a lot of money. Their turnover is huge in terms of their rates account. Their rates account is maybe 1%, 0.5%. I've seen those kind of ones. And then they want to have the rebate. And when they get the rebate, what's going to happen? When you look at their reserves, will they provide more services? No, why have they got the reserves already? Because the reserves is not specific for some project. And secondly, will they charge people less if it's something that charges a membership fee or a tuition fee? Definitely not. It's just going to be to ensure that they make more money for themselves. I want to stay with the Section 8. When I hear that there's one defaulter, and I thought maybe there's 1% of municipalities defaulting, but if there's one defaulter who is causing us to change the may create categories to must create categories, then I respectfully submit, honourable members of Parliament, that the right of the minister already in the Act to deal with those unfair rights being levied on government properties in certain small municipalities, that should be exercised. You do not go and you change the legislation for the whole of local government if there are 1 or 2 or 10 or 100 sinners out of, well, hundreds may be a lot, 1 or 2, I've heard about 1 or 2 or 10 out of 280-odd municipalities. You deal with the sinner and you punish and you correct the sinner. And also to talk about where the money is coming from that gives the rebates, whether that money on PSI will come from the national fiscus in income tax, or whether it comes from a municipality. The national fiscus is happy to say to a PBO, I can give you a tax exemption because I've got the VAT Act where I'm going to catch you on the money that you're spending. The municipality has only got one tax base, that's property rights. If we miss you on property rights, we can't tax you on anything else. So therefore, there must be a very distinct difference between what's happening in the Income Tax Act and what's happening in the Rights Act, and more importantly, in the rights policy. When I look at the ability of the rights policy to actually provide services that are based and funded by the local people, where the local people have got a right of discussing it with the councillors, and if they're not happy, not voting for them, so in other words, there's accountability, direct accountability, then I would say it is the right place to actually deal with those issues. The ratio that was created should only be for those who lack the ability to pay. Most of us in our rights policies, what we've seen in the people attending the Valuation and Rating Forum, which is a fairly wide forum, look at in their rights policies on an ability to pay principle for the people applying. If we centralize that, like we're doing currently, we're losing that evaluation, and we're losing the fact that you've got to make certain that every money that you as a municipality extend or spend or not collect must add value to the services that you're providing to the community, because that is what rights is being paid for. Honourable Chairperson, I'd like to get to the negative impact on the budget. The request to the Minister to review rates. If that is proposed to remain at 24 months, I'm saying that we're looking into a budget problem for local government. It should be less than 6 months. I've heard somebody mentioning here today 3 months. When we look at the 2 years, the first thing that we need to understand is The request will come in after the year to which it applies. The Auditor General's annual financial audit would have been performed, and he would have issued his audit report already. One can no longer open up that account. With all due respect, the court, the Supreme Court of Appeal, did not open that account in a number of cases where local government were found to have been incorrect. I don't want to mention a municipality present on the rights, but the court said you were wrong, but I cannot open your accounts again. The city of Cape Town had a problem with the right payer taking them to court to the Supreme Court of Appeal, also on a tariff issue. The court said, I cannot touch it. That financial year is gone. The council cannot go and redo their budget. They cannot go and reset their tariffs. Because at all times, in terms of the Municipal Finance Management Act, the MFMA, our budgets must balance. If during a financial year we budgeted that we're going to get 100 rand revenue from or cash from rates, and we get only 95 rand cash from rates, on the expenditure side, we got to reduce the 100 rand to 95 rand. That's during the year. How can we now ask of the minister to go and do a thing in retrospect? We cannot cause that retrospective loss of rights or the rebalancing of a budget after the year is actually closed. We must make certain that whatever comes out of this process is protecting the minister from unreasonable expectations that the people raising the issue with him would have, that the minister will do something about it, and knowing full well that already a court of law has decided, namely the Supreme Court of Appeal, that you cannot retrospectively change the budget and the tariffs of a municipality. We've also had the Constitutional Court, if I remember correctly, was also in a Johannesburg case in terms of water services, in terms of the free water, decided that it's not the court's place to decide how the municipality must structure their budget. So we are sitting with things that don't really gel 100% correct in terms of the impact if the 24 months remain. We submit it should be a lot less, and I do like what I've heard earlier today, that it would actually be from when the minister interacts with the municipality and comes to a decision, the next budget that we're starting. Because most of the cities don't start their budgets that comes in on the 1st of July, like in January or February. It starts in October, November already. So when it comes in January, February, a lot of preparatory work is done, and some would have their draft or their tabled budgets into the public domain already. Honourable Members of Parliament, the negative budget impact on the compulsory review of the 10% of the valuer's decision on objection. I'm going to ask my valuer friend to actually deal with that, Mr. Christopher Gavore.
Good afternoon, Honourable Members of Parliament and all guests. From a practical valuation point of view, we actually fail to understand the 10% allocation to review. We've subsequently discovered that the 10% is just an arbitrary figure. It hasn't got any basis to have been determined. Now, the Valuation Appeal Boards are not professional valuers. So what they do is they adjudicate between the valuer of the municipality and the property owner in case of a valuation dispute, even though they have a valuer as a member. So if the appeal board is now going to do, it's almost like doing a quality control of values.
Can I just interject there? It's my first time doing that, but I just picked it up saying that what is the act that it envisages to be amended on composition of the board, evaluation board? What is it saying?
No, it's not an amendment of the composition of the board. This is not part of the amendment to the bill. It's what we are proposing to be included in the amendment.
we are saying that, in summary, the appeal boards are now acting as a quality controller of the valuation process. So we fail to understand that the valuation board will now review a decision that has been taken. Let's say, for example, a property owner lodges an objection. It goes to the municipal valuer. Then it goes through to the valuation appeal board, and a decision is made. If the change is more or less than 10%, it is sent back to the valuation appeal board again to review. Now, if they make a ruling in terms of changing of value, the property owner is not there to defend whatever decision is made. And he doesn't have any other means of challenging that decision by the valuation appeal board. So we submit that there should be some proposal in the amendments to the bill to take away or review that 10% ruling in the legislation. Thank you.
I just want to be guided by members. IMF mentioned that precedent is still coming. I propose maybe that we reserve discussion, we take the next presenter, Chamber of Mines. Then when the president is back, we'll entertain questions. Is it fine?
Agree.
I'm trying to be more accommodating. You can't travel all the way and find that we are done. Because I've checked, why are you saying you're supposed to do your presentation at 2? They said there are some organizations that withdrew from the program that then it went up. So that's why I'm trying to be accommodative. Can we get the presentation from the Chamber of Mines? They are not here. Not yet here. What is the time now? It's lunchtime. So it means then it takes us to lunchtime. Let's try then and come get settled at Goratutu, so that we'll be able to fix the remaining time.
Okay.
Yes. Let's break for, and we don't have lunch around here. Let's break for lunch and come back at Goratutu.
She came to Parliament.
Where is
lunch? Oh, she's on the presidential candidate.
Is lunch here?
Okay.
Let's not do it.